You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
First Nations listeners are advised that the following program may contain the names and voices of our mob who have passed on to the dreaming.
Hi, listeners. Wallawani. You're listening to Yilliman on 3CR, 855M, you dial 3cr.org.au. Streamed online and via the playback service. That was a track by Rumpy Band, Jalangara Pakaranu, which means out from jail. So I did a little film clip on that one as well. I've got a few things to talk about today. First off though, I want to talk a bit about what happened on Monday. In particular, what happened over in Borlu, or Perth as it's otherwise known now by its colonial name. The bomb attack that happened over there, the attempted bombing, it was an act of terrorism at the end of the day. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, if you haven't seen it in the news, honestly, you know, it can be forgiven if you haven't seen it in the news, because the news hasn't really reported on it that well. It's been pretty pushed to the back of the news reporting, and even then, when it has been reported on, hasn't been reported on very well. I'm going to get to that in a minute. But yeah, essentially what happened was at the Survival Day, Day of Mourning protest over in Borlu or Perth, there was a homemade bomb that was thrown into the crowd. Now, luckily and thankfully, it didn't actually detonate, but it was an improvised shrapnel bomb. You know, it's filled with stuff like nails, screws and metal ball bearings. And there was a range of different explosive liquids within it as well. Now, this is, you know, absolutely despicable. It's absolutely disgusting. At the end of the day, it is, even though it's not being called this, it is a terrorist attack. You know, it was a attempted terrorist attack where mob were, you know, they attempted to attack mob at a day of mourning protest. And, you know, if it had have gone off that bomb, it would have been a mass casualty event. We don't know how many people would have, you know, been killed and injured from such a attack. You know, thrown into a very packed in crowd as well, by the way. And they haven't really released much about the perpetrator. There's, you know, a few photos floating around with blurred out face. They haven't given a name. They haven't actually stated his ideology or, you know, anything like that. But, you know, from the pictures, we can tell that this is what looks like a white Australian. And what other motivation could there be except for racism, you know, racial supremacy, hatred, fascism and colonialism? You know, this is nothing new at the end of the day for mob here. We've been dealing with these attacks now for, you know, 250 odd years, ever since Cook first, 256 this year actually, ever since Cook first came in to what's now known as Botany Bay up in Kamei, when he came in and he fired his shots at the Gwigal men that were on the shore telling him he wasn't welcome. It's just another continuation of that. And, you know, one thing I wanted to touch on, I'll touch on a few things about this, but one thing I wanted to touch on is the way that it hasn't really been reported. And, you know, even when it has been reported, I've seen a lot of the articles that have reported it, they very much undermine and downplay and diminish exactly what happened. You know, there's no news reports that are accurately naming this as a terrorist attack, which it was. And, you know, most of the news reports, nearly all of them in fact, are refusing to use words like bomb. Instead, they've just referred to it as a device. You know, a device was thrown into the crowd. You know, very much downplays and minimalizes what actually happened. Now, this downplaying and this minimalization is, again, you know, nothing new for mob, but it really highlights the hypocrisy here. You know, over the last 2 years, or more, but, you know, over the last 2 years in particular, we have seen a lot of incidences being labeled as terror and terrorism and terrorist attacks. And, you know, some of these incidences don't even actually impact anybody's life. or health. You know, stuff like even the other day when a colonial monument down here in so-called Melbourne was destroyed and defaced and had a red triangle spray painted onto the side of it. You know, you had news media like the Herald Sun referring to it as a psychological terror attack. You know, but they won't refer to the attempted bombing of a packed-in First Nations and supporters crowd as a terror attack. You know, it really highlights the hypocrisy. And, you know, there's been other incidences that have happened over the last 2 years, stuff like the synagogue doors that were burnt, that have been labelled terrorist attacks, and that have had all these condemnations from both the right and left-wing politicians and media. You know, they've all come out and they've denounced this, and they've all, you know, this synagogue doors burning, and, you know, there was extra police laws that have been brought in as a result of various different attacks on Jewish and Zionist institutions. But it's silence from the government in regards to this here attempted mass casualty event. You know, it's absolute hypocrisy and it's disgusting. You know, but one politician who has actually spoken out about it is Senator Lydia Thorpe, independent First Nations Senator Lydia Thorpe. She's released a media statement, which I'm going to read out now. It's titled, "Perth Bomb Attack Demands Comprehensive Response from Albanese." An attempted bombing at a day of mourning rally in Perth was a serious act of violence against First Peoples. Senator Lydia Thorpe has called for a full investigation, condemned the minimization of attacks on First Peoples, and urged the federal government to respond decisively to the rising threats against First Peoples as it did following the Bondi attack. Now, we've got some quotes that are attributable to Lydia Thorpe, Gunai Gunditjmara and Jabwarong Independent Victorian Senator. "What happened in Perth was not a minor incident. An explosive device was thrown into a crowd of First Peoples and supporters on our day of mourning. It was intended to detonate, but thankfully failed. This was a serious act of violence that could very easily have been a mass casualty event, and it must be treated as such. When violence is linked to Muslims, the word terrorism appears in headlines almost immediately. But when First Peoples are targeted by white supremacists, the response is silence, minimization, and delay. That double standard is glaring and deeply dangerous. It reflects the entrenched racism embedded across so many of this country's institutions. This attempted bombing follows a clear pattern. The ideologically driven neo-Nazi attack on First Peoples at Camp Sovereignty last year was also downplayed, with authorities refusing to recognize it as a hate crime or an act of terror. Time and again, violence against our people is treated as less serious. We need a comprehensive investigation, not only into the alleged perpetrator, but into the policing and intelligence failures that allowed First Peoples to be placed at risk of serious injury and death. Nearly 48 hours on, the public has been given almost no information about the motivation or ideology behind this attack. The identity of the alleged perpetrator has been suppressed, and police have not been transparent with elders. Police must do better in how they communicate with our people. Transparency, accountability, and clear communication are essential to community safety, particularly at a time when far-right extremism is an escalating threat. On its face, this appears to be a targeted, racist terror attack against First Peoples on our day of mourning. That possibility must be taken extremely seriously, not avoided or downplayed. All forms of hate and political violence must be called out consistently. First Peoples should not be treated as expendable or lesser than, and violence against us must never be normalized or ignored. The federal government must lead a comprehensive response. Their response following the horrific Bondi attack showed that strong leadership on violence and racism is possible when there is political will. We need the same seriousness and urgency applied to tackling the rising racism and violence against First Peoples across the continent." And that's the end of the media release that come out from Senator Forbes' office. But, you know, she you know, really hits a nail on the head. You know, how is it that when there is attacks against other community groups, you know, in particular community groups that, you know, for lack of a better term, white, that there is all of this, you know, condemnation and there is all of this action and urgency. But when it's against First Peoples, it is just minimalized, it's downplayed, it's not even spoken about. You know, I could be wrong, you know, I'll accept that I could be wrong, but as far as I'm aware, as far as I've seen, you know, people like Albanese haven't come out and said anything about this. You know, there's been no condemnations. But not only that, you know, in many regards, that's to be expected, I suppose, that the colonial government and the colonial media would ignore and or downplay such an event against our people. But something that I think is just as important, if not more important, is the fact that it's not just the colonial government and the colonial media that have been, for the most part, completely silent on this. It is also the so-called left in Australia. You know, when, and I've seen these myself, you know, over the last 2 years, when there have been actions against, you know, Jewish or Zionist institutions and groups, or when there has been graffiti that's pro-resistance and pro-October 7th, you've had people on the left who have come out and, you know, tried to distance themselves from it and claim that, you know, that's not them and that's not what Australia is and that's not what they stand for. And, you know, they've released all these statements and all these condemnations and, you know, carry on about it on social media. But when something like this happens to mob, you know, where's those same condemnations and same statements and same distancing from the so-called left here in Australia, the settler left? You know, where is all of their same energy when it comes to First Nations issues? It doesn't exist. It's not there. There's been a handful of individuals I've seen from the settler left who have, you know, mentioned this, but there's been nowhere near the same amount of energy or, you know, the same amount of dialogue that they would put into something like setting a bin on fire down at the Block the Dock protests, or, you know, that they would put into some graffiti that says, you know, do October 7th again. You know, it's absolute hypocrisy. It's disgusting. But it's to be expected. You know, that's what Australia is at the end of the day. And on that note, you know, I really want to highlight as well that while this was an extreme event, it wasn't an isolated incident. You know, it's not something that's unique or isolated. Last year, we had the terrorist attack on Camp Sovereignty. And, you know, that's exactly what it was. Terrorism is when you try and inflict terror on a group of people or a population, and you have political and ideological means to do it, you know, political and ideological motivation, I should say, to do it. That's what the attack on Camp Sovereignty was. It was a politically and ideologically motivated attack on First Peoples with the intention of distilling fear and terror into First Peoples down there. And, you know, that's just one incident. On Monday itself, on Invasion Day, there was other incidents that happened across the continent as well. You know, again, it wasn't as extreme as this one, but still violent incidences. Up in the Sunshine Coast, for example, there was a man in a, you know, I'm not entirely sure what it was, maybe a Ford Ranger or a Hilux or a Triton or something, you know, one of those big four-wheel drive dual cab utes, who mounted a crosswalk and mounted a footpath and tried to run over Aboriginal women and children who were leaving a Sorry Day event down in Canberra as well. You know, they had the March for Australia, and there was a point there where the March for Australia and the Invasion Day March kind of met. And what happened? You had full-grown white men coming in and physically attacking Aboriginal women and children. In fact, there was a 9-year-old as well who was even attacked by a full-grown white man. And, you know, down here in this city, in Melbourne, we had roaming groups of these neo-Nazis and these white supremacists getting around the city who were attacking and intimidating coloured people on the day, you know, First Nations people as well as coloured migrants from other backgrounds from the global south. You know, this is what it is to be Australian at the end of the day. You know, at the end of the day, we've got to remember Australia was founded on its white Australian policy, on its exclusion, and on its racism. You know, it never ended. It's still continuing today. It's still very much there because it's the foundations of Australia. It's so embedded into Australia. You know, people talk about the Australian culture. That's what the Australian culture is. The Australian culture is one of white supremacy, of racism, of hatred, of violence and terror. It always has been and it always will be. That's why, you know, I talk so much on this show about how things need to change, how we need to start really addressing stuff. And, you know, where that begins is right at home, you know, in your own home. One of my favourite sayings is clean up your own backyard. That's what people need to do. And not only that, they need to clean up the backyard of their own mental state, their own mentalities. They need to look in the mirror and realise who they are, reconcile with who they are and address who they are. Because we have so many people who claim to be progressive and communists and socialists and anarchists and, you know, whatever else, whatever other flavour of left-wing politics you identify as. We have so many settlers in those groups who themselves are anti-Indigenous, who are anti-Aboriginal, who fundamentally, whether they realise it or not, fundamentally subscribe to notions of white supremacy. And whether it's paternalistic racism or whether it's outright racism, it's still racism that they subscribe to. You know, they still subscribe to these colonial mentalities and ideas that this land is theirs, that it's not Aboriginal land, that Aboriginal people can be an afterthought, can be displaced and dispossessed still today. You know, that's why, for example, you know, we see all these people come out to pro-Palestine marches, for example, which is, you know, don't get me wrong, people should be going to those things and should be standing with Palestine and other places. But you don't see the same sort of crowds at a deaths in custody rally. You know, I've been to so many deaths in custody rallies. I've organised so many as well. And I've never seen anywhere near the same amount of crowd as what you'd see at your Sunday pro-Palestine rallies. Because at the end of the day, most people simply don't care. They don't care about us. They don't care that our people are being systematically murdered by this colony. They don't care that this colony is mass incarcerating us at the world's highest rates. You know, that's just an afterthought for them. It's not even an afterthought after time. It's not even a thought that enters their mind. You know, and on that note too, with the whole deaths in custody stuff, when police and corrective services personnel can murder our people and can get away with it, you know, that, in my opinion, is reflective of government policy. You know, at the end of the day, that's exactly what it is. When they're getting away with it, when they're not being reprimanded, when they have the conditions to be able to do it in the first place, you know, that's government policy that allows and empowers and enables that. There is a government policy here to continue to murder our people. You know, whether it's actually legislated explicitly word for word like that, or whether it's something that happens as a by-result of the way that it's worded and the way that it's enacted, is irrelevant. At the end of the day, it's government policy to murder our people. It's policies that have existed before Federation. It's policies that continue to exist today. Last year, we had the highest rates of Aboriginal deaths in custody since the Royal Commission in 91. And last year, we saw the very first, since 91, the very first police officer actually convicted of something. But even then, they weren't convicted of murder. They were convicted of negligence. You know, when a copper kills a First Nations person, the most and the only justice we've ever got for over 500 deaths now as well is one simple conviction of negligence. Absolutely disgusting. That's the reality that we live in, though. You know, violence is something that is very much a everyday factor for First Nations people. Whether it's being run down by bogans in their four-wheel drives, which, you know, again, Sunshine Coast wasn't an isolated incident. These kinds of incidences where Bogans run us down in their four-wheel drives. These happen all the time, especially right across rural and remote Aboriginal communities and rural and remote mainstream communities. You know, it's a commonplace. Up in my own community of Nowra, it was only a couple of years ago that we had a white Bogan in a four-wheel drive trying to mow down Aboriginal kids on their way home from school. You know, lucky they were able to get away. They had to jump through people's yards and over fences and whatever else to get away. They managed to escape, luckily. But then there was also an incident where, again, in my own home community of Nowra, and again, I'm only talking in the last couple of years, where somebody on their way home from school was ran down and killed by somebody else. You know, that's the sort of violence that we expect when we step outside of our door of a morning. You know, that's just from the civilians. You know, that's not even counting the violence that is enacted against us by the state, by the police, by the corrective services personnel. And it's not just violence of, you know, in the form of death or physical harm. There's also a lot of emotional and social harm that is enacted against us. When the state steals our children, that's violence. You know, what a violent act to rip a child away from their mother, to go and put them in an institution somewhere or go and adopt them out to a white family. You know, that's violence right there. When our people are forced into conditions where we're 10 times more likely to be homeless, you know, that's violence there. Depriving someone of safety and security and, you know, protection from the elements, that's violence. Sleeping on the street, in the cold, in the rain, in the scorching hot weather, that's violence at the end of the day that's being enacted against First Nations people. And there's so much more stuff I could go on and on about. There's so much stuff I could list, like the poisoning of our waterways and our soils and our foods. You know, that's the violence there that happens from the government, it happens from the Defence Force, it happens from the farms and the mines and the other extractive industries. You know, it's the violence when you've got places like Southern Launch launching rockets over the heads of our elders over in Gugga for Country. That's violence when they're blowing up our land. You know, but again, this is nothing new. It's just a continuation of the status quo here. And there's been so many horrific violent acts that people fail to reconcile with, fail to acknowledge. You know, every year it's marked the day when nuclear bombs were dropped on Japan at the end of World War II. But other days marked when nuclear bombs were dropped on First Nations country over in South Australia. You know, at Maralinga and Emu Fields, when the British and the United States militaries come and done their nuclear bomb tests. When First Nations people died from that, is that marked? Bet you, if you're listening, you wouldn't even know the date that happened. Probably don't even know the year it happened. You know, that's the sort of hypocrisy and irony I'm talking about here. You know, this colony is founded on violence against Aboriginal people, and it will continue to be that way until the colony is abolished.
You're listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned to hear the rest of your 3CR podcast.
Look, I said I wasn't going to talk about it anymore, but I am. I'm going to mention one or two other things quickly before I move on. First off, though, I do have a statement here from the Black People's Union that went out in regards to the attack over in Borloo. It reads, "This year, in the streets of Borloo, a terrorist attack was attempted against elders, the Indigenous community and accomplices who were standing against the boot of colonialism on January 26th. The terrorist's sole goal was the mass killing and injury of Aboriginal people with an improvised explosive device. We cannot condemn enough the vile acts perpetrated against our community. For us, Invasion Day is every day. Whether it be the violent evictions from homes, our young people being shot on the street, children being ripped out of their mother's arms, or the ongoing mass incarceration of our people, our community is viewed as expendable by the broader Australian community. This much is very clear. We condemn the colonial media of Australia and its complicity in pushing false narratives that harm our communities. We condemn also the lack of outrage not just that which is expected from the fascist press, but from the so-called allies that stood up around the continent, who have since gone silent at the attempted massacre of indigenous people on the anniversary this continent was invaded. It doesn't go unnoticed that when there is a threat against Zionist institutions, destruction of colonial monuments, or anti-Zionist graffiti, that it is in the press for weeks. This includes condemnations and statements from political parties and settler organizations of the so-called left. But when it comes to a near mass casualty event of our people, we are met with silence. When organizations say, "This isn't who we are," does that mean property is more important to their moral standing than the lives of Aboriginal people? Graffiti of a red triangle on a statue is labeled as terrorism, but a bomb thrown at a community is not. We also condemn the violence following the failed terrorist attack, where WA police brutalised a confused and worried community, risking a crowd crush as they used excessive force. All the while, the surrounding public was not dispersed in the same manner. This act of terrorism is not un-Australian. Violence is the Australian way of being. To call an act of terrorism un-Australian is to deny the historical truth that the system is built upon slaughter. Violence comes as no surprise to Indigenous people. It is on our doorstep every day we wake up, and it will continue after January 26th until the next Invasion Day returns. All around the continent, violence has been perpetrated against us. In Naam, the same perpetrators of the 2025 attack on Camp Sovereignty walked free, bashing people on the street. On Ngambri Ngunnawal country, a 9-year-old girl was amongst the crowd of women attacked by white men, and on Gubbi Gubbi country, a man attempted to run over a group of women and a child, leaving the Invasion Day rally. Violence is all Indigenous people know, because violence is all Australian culture has ever been. That's the end of the statement. And you know, on that note as well, as I was mentioning before about people not showing up, you know, if you're listening from Gadigal country, there is a, I believe it's this Saturday, no, sorry, next Saturday in Hyde Park in Sydney at 12 p.m. there is a Stop the Deaths in Custody march. They'll be marching from Hyde Park to the Surry Hills Police Station. The theme is Justice for All Aboriginal Lives Lost, and it has been organised by the Black Caucus. So, you know, if you are up and around Gadigal country in 2 weekends' time, make sure you actually show up and support that. Make sure you get out there. And when you see deaths in custody rallies down here in Naam, get along to them as well. And don't just rock up to the rallies and think that because you've gone to a rally or a protest, you can pat yourself on the back and all is well. It takes a lot more than that. It takes actual material support and material solidarity. You know, you, if you're a settler and you're listening, you live in occupied lands. You live on the proceeds of our genocide. You know, everything that white Australians and Australian settlers generally have, they have because of our dispossession, our displacement, our invasion, our occupation, and our genocide. You know, it's very ironic, I think, when you hear these white racists talk about Aboriginal people as being dole bludgers and, you know, Centrelink recipients and handout welfare queens and whatever else. You know, it's such a projection. Because at the end of the day, you know, everything that white Australia has comes from us. Whether it's our stolen land or our stolen resources, or whether it's our stolen labour which built this nation, this colony. You know, it all comes from us. You wouldn't have your house, your job, your food, your clothes, your car. You wouldn't have any of that if it wasn't for our dispossession, displacement, genocide and occupation. And it's our ongoing occupation, our ongoing genocide, our ongoing displacement and dispossession which continues to fuel the Western lifestyle that so many people are comfortable with here in this colony. So people really need to think about that. Really need to think about what they're going to do. How you're going to materially support First Nations people. Don't just rock up to rallies. Do that as well, but don't just do that. Don't just stop there. You know, donate to our campaigns and our causes. Help us actually do stuff. If you've got skills, get in touch with these organizations that do stuff and loan your skills. You know, loan your labor. Go and put in some effort to actually help us with stuff. And if you're not going to do that, the very least you could do is reach deep into your pockets and your wallets and your bank accounts and donate what you can so that we have the resources to actually be able to fight for some justice and some equality here in this colony. Because, you know, without it, we're a disenfranchised, impoverished people struggling against the colonial boot of the Western Empire, and we won't get very far without solidarity, actual material, real solidarity, not just marching in the street, but resources, skills, labour. That's what we actually need. Look, before I go to the good news, there's one more thing I want to mention, because I know that quite a lot of non-Indigenous, you know, people here on this continent, quite a lot of Australians, don't actually realise the recentness of so much of the violence. You know, this attempted terrorist attack might seem like something that's completely out of the blue, but you know, aside from all the deaths in custody and stolen children and, you know, Aboriginal kids being mowed down by bogans in their four-wheel drives, there has actually been massacres that have continued well after the last officially acknowledged massacre. I think it was in the 1920s. You know, there's been massacres that have happened since. And for the most part, you know, they're either not labelled that or they're not even acknowledged at all. Pardon me. But, you know, one I really want to just touch on, just to highlight how recent all this stuff is in our lived memory, is the Skull Creek Massacre of 1975 over just outside of Laverton in Western Australia. And yes, you heard that date right, 1975, 51 years ago this year. And, you know, I've only ever seen this be spoken about by other Aboriginal people and, you know, Aboriginal organisations like the Ten Embassy and like the Sovereign Union. But, you know, I'll just give you a bit of a quick rundown of what happened. You know, there was a brutal massacre that occurred in Laverton, Western Australia, in 1975 by the Western Australian Police and a few of the local racist rednecks who were friends with the cops, and which has, you know, since become known to local blackfellas as the Skull Creek Massacre. Now, as I said, you know, this occurred only 51 years ago, and it was very much covered up by the Laverton Police, and it was disguised as the so-called Skull Creek Incident, where no deaths were ever actually recorded. Instead, all that was recorded was tensions between Laverton Police and supposedly unruly Aboriginal people. Now, around 100 Aboriginal people, you know, men, women and children, had travelled in from Warburton in WA to travel to a site for a ceremonial gathering in Laverton when a whole bunch of police officers and their friends intercepted them at the ceremonial site and massacred most of them. You know, there's various Aboriginal people from the local area who have all reported the same number as being around 100 people that were killed. Now, there was a Royal Commission into the 1975 incident, and it was documented as the, you know, so-called Skull Creek Incident. But this Royal Commission made no mention of a massacre. All it did was make mention of 75 people who were involved in the incident. Now, there was also a report that came out by the Australian Institute of Criminology, which noted that the Royal Commission had found that most of the evidence that was given by police in subsequent court proceedings had been fabricated evidence. You know, it wasn't truthful evidence, it was all fabricated. And, you know, at the end of the day, this Skull Creek Massacre remains a very haunting tale that gets handed on, you know, discreetly and carefully behind closed doors. It's not something that is, you know, acknowledged by the mainstream. It's definitely not acknowledged by the government. And, you know, the actual massacre site itself remains unmarked out there. And it's, you know, said to be on the right side of the Laverton sign just when you're entering the township. But, you know, this is how recent this stuff was. And in fact, there's even stuff more recently than that. You know, back in the 1990s, up in Alice Springs, and I was actually living in Alice Springs in the 90s myself. But back in the 90s in Alice Springs, you had barkeepers and, you know, people who worked in restaurants and other similar food and drink shops who were poisoning Aboriginal people's food and drinks. You know, they were using stuff like strychnine which is a poison that you get from, I believe it's from the castor plant. But, you know, they were using this poison to poison blackfellas up there. And there was actually a whole bunch that died and like several, many more who were hospitalized as a result. And, you know, this isn't referred to as any kind of massacre. And I don't know if you Googled if you would even find many results, if any at all. But, you know, this is only in the 90s. This is younger than me. You know, I was alive and living there at the time. You know, that's how recent this stuff is. And I'm not a very old person. I'm in my early to mid-30s. You know, that's how recent this stuff is, these mass deaths. You know, it's not something that happened 200 years ago, as you hear idiots carry on about. It's something that happens and has continued to happen ever since colonization began. And if this bomb had have been detonated the other day, if it had have gone off on Monday, like it was intended to, we would have had another massacre, you know, in the 21st century. That's the reality that you live in Australia. Look, I've got about just over 10 minutes left in the show. And I did say I'd have some good news, so, you know, I'll get to that. I'll move on from all the negative. And, you know, one of the really good news that I woke up to this morning was actually from our own country, from the Nowra local court, actually, up in Nowra there on the south coast of New South Wales, up in Yuin country, which was 7 of our local wild bunja men up there who had been accused of illegally trafficking abalone, all had their charges withdrawn. And it's a very big win for us. It's, you know, it's sad that it's even a win. And it's sad that we can call this a win and a good news story. First Nations people taking the resources that we've been harvesting for 100,000 years or more, you know, still being allowed to do it. But yeah, it's, I suppose, you know, in the current political climate and the reality of it all, it is, you know, to be seen as a bit of a win. Now, if you're a bit unfamiliar with what abalone is, it's a delicacy in our culture. It's a type of shellfish that you get from the ocean. It tastes absolutely delicious. It's, you know, one of the yummiest seafoods that you can get. But, you know, the Australian laws are very strict on, you know, poaching abalone. And in fact, you can get something like a $100,000 fine and up to 10 years in jail. You know, that's how strict the punishment is. 10 years in jail for being convicted of poaching abalone. You know, I just want to remind listeners that at the end of the day, First Nations people can't be determined. As far as I'm concerned, you know, it's not right that we could be charged with poaching for taking our traditional foods. The only people, as far as I'm concerned, that have any right to accuse First Nations people of poaching are our own elders and traditional owners of country. You know, they're the ones who get to decide whether or not a poaching limit has been breached and, you know, people are poaching our food. It's not up to the colonial government to decide if we're poaching or not. But yeah, it's a good win, I suppose. These people all had these 7 followers, all had their charges withdrawn. So, you know, that's a good news story, as far as I'm concerned. You know, the way it works too with the whole Gammon native title crap is that apparently, you know, Aboriginal people are only allowed to possess and take up to 10 abalone per day for cultural needs. You know, again, that's crap. You know, we traded for colonization. Part of our culture is trade. You know, we've always traded. We traded right up into Southeast Asia, across to, you know, Aotearoa, and, you know, right up through all of the Oceania region and the Southeast Asian region. You know, we've been trading since before the British even first got on their boats and went anywhere to colonize anywhere. So, you know, we should be allowed to continue to trade if we want to. If we want to take 100 abalone and we want to go sell them, that should be our cultural right. You know, who are colonial occupiers to tell us what we can and can't take and what we can and can't do with it and how much we can and can't take? You know, it's crap. But yeah, it's a good news story. They had these charges withdrawn, which is good for them. Like, deadly work follows and deadly work for the lawyer up there. And, you know, I'm not going to lie, I had a bit of a read of the article, and the argument that the lawyer used was a bit ironic and a bit funny. He more or less said that because Fisheries, New South Wales Fisheries, which is the department that charges for this stuff, they had taken all these pictures and they had accused these men of evidence that they had gathered from like several hundred metres away, you know, apparently looking through binoculars and telescopic cameras to see, you know, that these men were taking abalone. And the lawyer more or less turned around and was like, well, all the mob on the South Coast all have, you know, fresh haircuts and, you know, they all look good and they all look the same. So how do you know it was even them? Which, you know, is a bit ironic, like the whole argument of, oh, these black fellas all look the same. How do you know it was them that was taking it? But, yeah, you know, at the end of the day, if it works, it works. Good on them for getting off. Now, we got about 5 or so minutes left on the show, and there's one other... pardon me. There's one other exciting bit of news I wanted to announce. You know, just unofficially announce it for the listeners who are tuned in today. The official announcement is going to go out tomorrow. But the next edition of the Sunday paper, that'll be edition 4, is going on pre-order tomorrow. Tomorrow you'll be able to head to the Sunday paper's website or you'll be able to head to their social media and see that they've announced pre-orders and you'll be able to pre-order yourself a copy of the next edition. I'm not going to go too much more into it. In fact, you know, tune in next week. Next week I'm going to have one of the main people behind the Sunday paper, Matt Chun, come and join me on the show and we're going to have a bit of a yarn about what this next edition is all about and, you know, why people should go out and buy a copy. But yeah, very excited to give you a little sneaky announcement a day early that pre-orders are going on sale tomorrow.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.